The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Court has three matters on its oral submission docket this morning. In the order in which they will be presented, they are docket number 030914, Hyundai Motor Company versus Victor Manuel Vasquez and others from Bexar County and the 4th Court of Appeals District. Second one is 031189, Daimler Chrysler Corporation against Inman from Nueces County and the 13th Court of Appeals District. Third one is 040016, Michiana Easy Living Country versus Holton from Harris County and the 1st Court of Appeals District. Court has allotted 20 minutes per side for each of these three cases. The court will hear all three cases this morning and take a brief recess in between each argument, finishing before lunch. The arguments are being recorded, but tapes are no longer being made by the clerk. They are being posted. The recording is being posted to the court's website and will be available sometime this afternoon. Chief Justice Jefferson is not sitting in the first case, and Justice Green, that's the Hyundai Motor Company case. Justice Wainwright is not sitting in the third case. The court has a vacancy, which we expect the governor to fill imminently, and that justice may choose to participate in the decision of these cases. The court is ready to hear argument in the first case, Hyundai Motor Company versus Vasquez.
May it please the court, Mr. David Keltner will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. If it pleases the court, I'd like to start by thanking the court for postponing this oral argument so I could attend my mother's last illness. And I want to publicly thank the plaintiff's lawyers, who were very gracious. Went so far as they were on a trip to stop and call and give their permission to do that. And I appreciate that courtesy and also the kind words that I received both from Mike Cadell and Ricardo Cedillo. That having been said, we have a very serious disagreement in this case, and as you know, it involves voir dire. Both sides think jury selection is incredibly important to the jury process. And also, it is important to pick a non-biased and non-prejudiced jury. We differ, though, tremendously on how to get that done. The plaintiffs believe in this case that they are entitled to preview facts, operative facts, before a jury panel. Facts that will be introduced into evidence, facts that the jury would have to consider to answer what the court's charge would be. Some of these facts even, and they do not dispute this, might even be dispositive of at least two of the questions asked the jury, both liability and causation. They believe that they can preview those facts, and well, under the guise of asking about bias,
You say facts. I mean, isn't the only fact we're dealing with the non-seatbelt use?
Yes.
Okay, so really it's just the one fact. And how do you, looking at the Standifer case, do you think there's any reason for our jurisprudence to be different?
Yes, Your Honor, we do. I think the court has an opportunity here to redefine what a commitment question is, and equally as important, to deal with situations in which jurors are invited, or potential jurors, are invited to give their initial reactions to weighing of the evidence prior to the time they're selected to get jury.
Let me follow up, because in Standifer, they seem to say that it would be okay to say, are you biased against nuns?
Well, actually,
would you say that's proper?
Your Honor, actually, in Barajas, the Court of Criminal Appeals reversed that decision, and that would no longer be an appropriate question according to the court of criminal appeals.
Now, I thought that question was appropriate. Are you biased against nuns?
No, I'm sorry. You were right about that, and perhaps I misspoke about the precise holding. Are you biased against nuns would be an appropriate question,
okay,
according to the court of criminal
appeals.
So what
if you said, are you biased against non-seatbelt users? Is that appropriate?
It could very well be, and that could have been a question that could have been asked here.
And here's the question.
But Your Honor,
would the jurors be predisposed if there's no seatbelt use? How's that different from would you be biased against a non-seatbelt user?
First off, let me say this. I think the issue, I want to draw one distinction from your previous question. I think the issue always is going to be a difference between operative facts that the jury is going to be called upon to weigh. As the Court of Criminal Appeals said, both in Barajas and Standifer, in reviewing their previous Nuncio decision, the issue about the victim being a nun was not an operative fact that would drive the court's decision. The fact of who the victim is not an element goes to any element of the case that the court, that the jury would have to decide. Seatbelt use is different because it is an operative fact that would drive a defensive theory of the defendants and would drive causation.
So are you saying then if the victim was a nun, that asking if you're biased against nuns would be improper?
No, ma'am. What I'm saying is if you were a nun and the big issue was, let's say it was the defendant was a nun or the victim was a nun, I think that would be an appropriate question, yes.
An appropriate or inappropriate?
No, a appropriate question. A proper question, how's that?
But again, I'm not sure I understand the distinction between saying, are you biased against non-seatbelt users?
I think that might very well be an appropriate question. I think it is not appropriate to say what the plaintiffs attempted to do in this case is young Amber was in the front seat, unbuckled. Is that going to be something that will drive your decision?
Well, that's not the way I read the question that they seem to want to posit, and that was, is there a preconceived notion that if there is no seatbelt use, you couldn't be fair?
Well, that is the question I think we have a problem with the issue with the issue of what question was asked. As the court knows.
But don't we have to know that before we can answer this?
Yes, to some extent, but I asked this question too. That was not important to the San Antonio Court of Appeals. Generally, we don't see reversals of trial court's rulings on Boyd Dyer without knowing the precise question that was going to be asked. And we have that issue here. And I don't blame the plaintiffs for this in one respect because of the way it arose. But nonetheless, I think that there's no doubt that on the initial panel, the question was different. And what the question that was actually asked to the jurors is, do you have a preconceived notion? And is it something that once you hear that evidence, the whole matter for you is over, as the plaintiffs put it? Now, if that's the case, what we are asking the jury to do is give an initial opinion on what their view of the evidence is. And then do what the plaintiffs did here, attempt to strike the juror for cause. And that, I think, is inappropriate. Why could we strike a juror for performing the very task the juror is going to be required to do in answering the court's charge?
So it was the defendant's theory of the case, at least in part, that if a child doesn't wear a seatbelt in the front seat, your damages are worse or entirely due to that fact rather than the airbag.
Yes, Your Honor. And let me say that it went to really more questions than that. And the plaintiffs do not disagree with this. It went to the liability question number one and also went to the causation question number two, and crucial. I think the plaintiffs, at least in their briefing, tell you that the reason they believe this is okay is the Babcock decision. As the court knows, that this is a decision that was written in 89. Interestingly, this court has not had an opportunity to look at commitment questions or questions where evidence is invited to be weighed in over 20 years. Babcock, Letford was a different kind of case that reached this court back in the late 90s. But the real truth of the matter is that in their reliance on Babcock, they read it very broadly. I know the court remembers the facts in Babcock. That was a case tried in, right around the 87 legislative session in which tort reform was first brought up. Justice Mosley, in his opinion, takes judicial notice that there is a controversy in the state that no one could escape, lots of ads on airwaves. And in fact, he points out that one of the jurors had read some of the advertisement or listened to it on TV and had the fear that if he voted in favor of the plaintiff, that insurance premiums might be increased, and said that exactly. Now, Justice Mosley decided this case under the Government Code 62.105, Provision 2, and he says directly that this was a question about whether the jurors had an indirect or direct interest in the case. And based on that, he said it was error of the trial court to refuse to allow further questions of the jury panel on that. Now, the interesting thing there, I think, is that it dealt with outside societal influences. That case had nothing to do with the operative facts and the jurors' reactions to them. And I think those are different things.
Suppose we have a divided society where half the people think there's way too many lawsuits and verdicts are way too big, and the other half think that people are getting killed and they're not getting compensated, and so everybody has a strong feeling. It's all from outside. Is it your theory we can't have a jury in that case at all? Or is it your theory that we should only have a jury made up of those handful of people who are so oblivious to current affairs they have no opinion about this?
Oh, Your Honor, I think two answers to that question. First, we obviously don't, all people that are going to serve are going to have some biases and prejudice. If this court said in Henry versus Compton, Compton versus Henry, rather, the issue about whether there's bias is one thing. Whether it is bias that gets rid of someone is something else, where you become impartial, where there's a subjective feeling of impartiality. The theory, I think, is you can't have any direct or indirect interest. You can't have a feeling. My mother, God rest her soul, truly believed that people ought never to sue for anything. And she had, it gave her great pain that I was involved in a profession that dealt with that. But Mom would not have been a great juror and may not have been an appropriate juror in many of those cases. Now, it often comes down to a question of degree, of whether how far things will go. The one thing, though, is I don't think Babcock answers the questions raised in this case. And I don't, because Babcock didn't deal with operative facts. There was no opportunity to find out what the juror was thinking and then decide what to do based on that.
Our sister court says there's disagreement among the judges about whether you just can't ask those questions that seek a commitment, or whether it's okay to ask the question but a judge can't strike them for cause because of their answer. What's your position on that?
The interesting dichotomy. I first think that it would be always improper to strike for cause based on the juror's initial evaluation of the evidence, period and paragraph. That issue is not truly raised in this case, but it is one this case ought to, the court ought to address in that regard. The second thing is, I think under some circumstances, you ought to be able to ask some type of commitment questions. I think the standard for line of cases indicates well what you ought to do in that regard. I think the Court of Criminal Appeals has thought this out fairly well. And a commitment question dealing again with the operative facts of the case, and that's what we're dealing with here.
But you're always dealing with operative facts of a case, and what you're trying to get at is prejudice that might view those facts based on something other than those facts. So if, for example, let's say you had a product liability case and the driver was alleged to be drunk, but it doesn't matter because the car exploded because of some fuel line defect, how would you ferret out prejudice against drunk drivers? You'd have to ask, do you have a prejudice against drunk drivers that would cause you to ignore any other evidence presented in the case?
Your Honor, you raise an interesting point. Here's how I think the court can address that and the guidelines that you could set. I think on one hand, it is very appropriate to ask that kind of question. But let's apply it another way, and it shows you a different result that I think should be impermissible, and I believe under Texas case law is. And that would be my client had 10 beers in the hour before the accident. Are you going to hold that against him, or can you listen to all the evidence?
You're arguing nuances here, but you prefaced it with, we don't know the question that we're talking about. So I'm struggling with that concept. It sounds to me as though the question they claim that was presented, you wouldn't have any problem with if, in fact, that was the question that was presented.
Your Honor, I do, in one respect, yes. And let me, this is a difficult part of this record. Remember, in the first Court of Appeals opinion, the court said they could have asked the question you posited. The question was, do you have, if you don't buckle seatbelts, do you have a bias against people who don't? You know, that's an interesting question. Does bias get it? Is bias and prejudice something a jury understands? Thomas Jefferson is biased in favor of jury trials. Was he prejudiced in favor of jury trials? I think that's an unfair characterization. I think that, when we're dealing with jurors and asking them the questions, especially since the 226A instructions are not given to the, I mean, the ones that are really good about follow my instructions, listen to all the evidence, they're not given before voir dire selection. They're given only after the jury is impaneled. And I think that, there can be a huge volume for error here. Your initial question to me was one I don't think I quite answered, and that is this. Since we don't know precisely what the question is, how can we say there's error? My point, how can the Court of Appeals reverse the trial court's discretion? And trial courts are on the firing line. You've been there. You know what that's like. They're on the firing line. This judge on the record said, listen, I think we have a problem here. I think we have a problem because I think the jury is interpreting this as the weight they should give the evidence. That's what we ought to be given some discretion to. That's where I think we ought to be given the plan.
Any other questions?
Yeah, let me ask you a question about the same topic, get to a different subject here. If the plaintiff is addressing the panel during voir dire and says, this is a personal injury case, my client's been injured, they're in the hospital, suffered a lot, no permanent injuries, but is there anybody here who absolutely couldn't award millions of dollars if I proved my case? Do you think that's a proper question?
No. And Your Honor.
Okay. Well, let me ask you another question, and then I'll let you explain. What if the plaintiff's counsel asks, is there anyone here, based on those same brief facts, who could never consider awarding millions of dollars if I proved my case? Different question or same question? The difference is award versus consider awarding.
Yes. I think it is the same question asked more artfully. Just like the question is that Justice Brister has written about before of, after what you've heard, who are you for? Versus the question, is your mind already made up? They're the same question, just a difference in degree. And if we're going to deal with difference of degrees, we have to give the trial court broad discretion. The court who is looking at the parties, making a determination of what's happened, seeing the impact on the jury panel, and just like this judge, made a decision that she put on the record of what she thought was happening.
So which of my two questions is improper, if either, in your opinion?
Depending on the circumstances, both.
Only the circumstances I gave.
Your Honor, I think that it is less likely that the second one is improper. I think that, and that's a question that has been allowed in past cases. Interestingly, I couldn't find a case that absolutely blesses that question.
Thank you, counsel. The court's ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Cadell will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. The question that we anticipated would be asked, the question that had been represented to us would be asked, was the same question that Judge Spiegelman, now Justice Judge Spiegelman with the Fourth Court of Appeals, asked of the second voir dire panel. The first voir dire panel Mr. Cedillo asked the question himself. It was rambling. It often will dire. It doesn't look very pretty when it's transcribed. And we disqualified, of the panel, we had only 48, and 29 out of 48 said, I can't listen to all the evidence.
I mean, the fact is, we want people to be biased against putting their four-year-old children in the front seat with no seatbelt. I mean, it's illegal.
And I'll get to that, because there's no question that that is an important fact. In fact, someone wrote, impartiality is not the absence of initial impressions, but the willingness to keep an open mind. And that was Justice Brister in his article on wanted, uninformed, docile jurors. So we're not here talking about whether seatbelt use or non-seatbelt use is important. We all concede it's important. We all concede that at the end of the day, a juror might very well conclude that that fact was dispositive. What we're here about is, do the parties have the right to ask the jurors, the panel, if they can follow their oath, if they can follow the court's instructions and listen to all the evidence? And this is the question that we thought would be asked. And this was the question that was asked to the second panel by Judge Speedlin. First, she had already told them that she would give them instructions and that one of the things they would have to do is they would have to listen to all the evidence. And this, I'm quoting from the record, remember, I said you also had to decide this case based on all the evidence that you hear in this case, not parts of the evidence or part facts, but every case has certain facts. This case, for example, I anticipate that the facts you will hear in this case is that Amber was in that car and she was not wearing a seatbelt. Here's the question I have. Remember, once you are in that jury box, you are going to swear to me and you are going to promise to me that you are going to wait to hear all of the evidence that comes in and you are going to follow the law that I give you before you return your verdict. Is there anyone sitting there among you that believes that one fact alone, that Amber was not wearing her seatbelt, that one fact alone would prevent you from following your oath and that you would not decide this case on all of the evidence? If you believe you could not wait and listen to all of the evidence before you decide this case, please raise your hand based on that one fact alone. Now, that cannot be an improper instruction because it does not ask what weight you will give to it. It does not ask the jurors to commit that they will disregard that fact. It does not ask them to commit that they will consider it. It simply says, can you follow your oath knowing that fact? Just as...
But what part of the oath?
The part it's where you say you will
you
follow...
Will you listen to all the evidence?
Correct.
Now, of course, under that theory, that would mean that any judge that grants a summary judgment is biased. Because you're saying, as before a trial, before anybody gets on the stand, as a matter of law, you lose. And judge that grants that, not biased, are you? Just because you don't listen to everything that might happen at a trial.
Justice Brister, I think you have put your finger right on the critical bright line. If a fact is so dispositive that that fact relieves all of us from the obligation of listening to the rest of the evidence, then that is a summary judgment fact. And that case should never be presented to a jury. But once a case has survived summary judgment or the opportunity for summary judgment and it is presented to the jury, this court's Rules of Civil Procedure, 226A Section 2, says, it is your duty, and this is the court's instruction to the jury panel, it is your duty to listen to and consider the evidence. And the court has to instruct the jury, you will need to consider all the evidence. Now, I go back to your article, Justice Brister, where you say impartiality is not an issue of or the absence of initial impressions, but the willingness to keep an open mind. And if we can't ask jurors in voir dire if they can keep an open mind, regardless of one particular fact, then the right to a fair and impartial jury has become meaningless.
I mean, we're trying to draw some lines here, and everyone seems to agree that it's a pretty nuanced question. What question are you complaining that you were not allowed to ask?
The question that Judge Speedlin asked, can you listen to all the evidence? Because what happened in this case was after she asked that question of the second panel.
But it's the preface to that that's important. It's not, can you listen to all the evidence? It's, if I told you that, you know, that she was standing up, and I understand that was disputed, if I told you she was standing up, would you be prejudiced against her? If I told you that the driver was fiddling with the radio, would that affect your decision? I mean, that's a pretty broad umbrella.
And let me tell the court that I don't like the use of the term prejudice or bias. And I've read the articles. I will note that the Court of Criminal Appeals in the Standifer decision does use the language fair and impartial. I think if you want a bright line, it's ironic that we say we want smart jurors and informed jurors, but then to some extent this is a discussion of how ignorant we think jurors really are, because we say, well, they don't understand what it means to be fair and impartial. If we condescend to jurors and say they don't understand what it means to be fair and impartial, then the bright line is you ask them, can you listen to all the evidence before you make your decision? I think you preface that with any fact.
So you can through your entire case and say, if my client is struggling under cross examination, can you promise me you'll be fair and impartial? That'd be okay.
Again,
it's the preface. I understand.
And the answer is, I think yes. Now, I think you can take it to an extreme, and taken to an extreme, anything becomes ridiculous, frankly. I mean, at some point, you have to cut things off in voir dire and time limits. I don't think 15 minutes is enough, but I think those are appropriate. You'll find the right amount of time.
But you think laying out each fact and asking if you can still keep an open mind is appropriate?
I think laying out critical facts. Let me give you an example. In this case, Hyundai's counsel at trial asked, you're going to find that the evidence is that an airbag exploded, you know, they didn't use the term exploded, but deployed, and it caught a 4.5-year-old little girl under her chin and snapped her neck back and killed her. Is there anyone among you who, simply hearing that this involves the death of a 4.5-year-old child, cannot listen to all the evidence and be fair and impartial to Hyundai? They asked that question. Is that a proper question? I say yes, because they're entitled to a fair trial. They're entitled to know.
The reality of the phenomenon is the more of those questions you ask, the more jurors start saying, I'm for this, I'm not for that, and they start doing what they're supposed to do, which is decide the case. They're not going to be able to sit there like a law professor and say, yes, I can be fair. They're going to start emoting toward a decision, it seems to me.
Well, Justice...
As you tick through the facts, when both lawyers get to the end, the jury's going to be ready to make up their mind at that point. And then if you say, well, can you listen to all the rest of the evidence? Well, I mean, as a technical matter, you can. But you've pretty much made up your mind.
I've tried a lot of cases. I think it is a canard that most jurors make up their minds during voir dire. That's simply not true. I think Justice Brister is right.
I agree with that, but they think they have.
Well, I think, and I think I was going to say,
and if you ask them whether they have, they'll say yes. And then if you put them on the panel, it turns out they haven't.
I think Justice Brister is right that they often have initial impressions or initial reactions, and those may be strong, but I don't think that means that you should not secure from them a commitment and be able to probe as to the authenticity, the validity of their commitment.
But the judge tried that. The judge, the lawyers tried, then the judge tried it and busted both panels. Why can't we let the judge say, in order to get this case tried, and we need to provide the trial judges with more guidance in this area, but trial judges need to have the discretion, don't they, to say, in order to get this case tried and get a jury that can do the job legally under Texas law, we're going to have to do something different here. I tried what you're suggesting by letting the lawyers try it, and I tried it by myself even explaining that.
this is what the judge, Judge Speedland's thinking, I know, having sat in her shoes many, many times. And then finally she had to do something else to get the case tried. Why not fall back on the judge's reasoned discretion in this case?
Expediency is no substitute for a fair and impartial jury.
Well, I think
that's the answer.
Well, what I'm suggesting is not that you extinguish justice in favor of expediency. It's that you don't ask the same question over and over and bus panel over and over and over and over again. And she let you try your question, and she asked your question and busted both panels.
And what happened was, Your Honor, we would not have busted the third panel. And if you look at the record, and in fact I've got it here, what happened was after the second panel was busted, we pointed out to the court, and I said to the court, of course these issues are important. All of these issues are important. The question is not whether the juror, prospective juror, thinks it's important. The question is whether the juror thinks it is so dispositive that the juror will be unable to consider the rest of the important issues in the case, consider the evidence. So what we did was we said, Judge, we didn't disqualify everyone. We disqualified about one-third to one-half of the first two panels. What does that tell you? You need a bigger panel. We only needed 26 jurors from which to make our selection, make our strikes. At most, give us a couple. And so what we suggested was get a bigger panel. And that's what Judge Speedland agreed to do and decided to do.
Of course,
and the third panel was 72.
The more people we disqualify, the less representative the jury's going to be as far as a cross-section of the community.
When you say that, let's say we're selecting a jury in the 1930s in Texas or 1940s in Texas, and the case involves a black man. So let's say we're picking a jury today, and the case involves a black man. Does that mean that if we disqualify half of the jurors because we say, can you be fair and listen to all the evidence if you know that the plaintiff or the defendant is black?
Well, it seems.
And people say, no, I can't do that.
I don't think
again,
there's
does
much
that
disagreement
mean?
Here that any kind of external bias should be fully inquired about. So if the mere fact, which had nothing to do with the case, that someone is older or younger, or a particular gender or race, or lives in a particular place, has anything to do with the outcome of this case, when logically it doesn't. And if anybody thinks that, we'd like to know about it. That would clearly be a disqualifying kind of thing. But when you get into the facts of the case, that's where it gets harder.
Judge, Justice Heck, with all due respect, virtually every fact has the potential to be an operative fact in the case.
You know,
in federal court,
in lots of jurisdictions, the lawyers don't get to ask any questions at all on voir dire. And you're basically asking us to say, if a judge did that in Texas, which they could do, I think, if they chose to do it, and you handed them this question and said, you've got to ask this question, and if you don't, I'm going to get you reversed on appeal. That's basically what you're asking us to say, that you can dictate to a judge, even, who's doing the voir dire, what questions have to be asked.
Justice Owen, I'm asking this court to follow the law in Texas.
So
that's what I'm asking for. I'm asking this court to apply the law of voir dire has been the law in Texas for 100 years.
Well, it's not the law in criminal cases.
Actually, Your Honor.
And here's my problem. We're one of two states that has two high courts. We can't tell them what the law of voir dire is. They can't tell us what the law of voir dire is. And I'm having trouble. Theirs is clearly more restrictive than ours. And I'm having trouble why lawyers should be more restrictive when it's only your life and liberty that at stake. But lawyers should be wide open voir dire when we're talking about money.
Well, let's read from the Standiford decision. What they said in the Standiford decision, and by the way, what happened, the nun issue was if the victim was a nun. Could you be fair? And the question was, of course, many questions in voir dire are not commitment questions, are not covered by this opinion. For example, the question, if the victim is a nun, could the prospective juror be fair and impartial? Does not ask the prospective juror to resolve or refrain from resolving any issue.
Well, of course, as Mr. Keltner pointed out, they changed that within the year, and they said you can't ask whether it would make any difference, you'd be unfair if the victim was a child. Because in a criminal case, you can give a stiffer punishment if the victim's a child. It's something a reasonable juror can do, and if it's a decision reasonable jurors can make on the facts, according to them, you can't even ask the question. Where do you stand, by the way, on the issue of does it make a difference whether you can ask the question, but the judge can't strike them for cause, or that you've got to have the right to do both?
Okay. First, you have to have the right to ask the question. I think that's fundamental. By the way, I disagree with, respectfully, the interpretation of the Barajas decision. I don't think that it makes that question about whether a nun is the victim, could you be fair and impartial, I don't think it says that that question is not permissible in the Court of Criminal Appeals. I think that's a misreading of that opinion, and I actually believe that Mr. Keltner conceded that that is not an improper question, even today, under the Court of Criminal Appeals decisions. The second question, though, is I think you have to disqualify a juror who says, I'm not going to listen to all the evidence. If we had a...
Well, that's substantially different. A juror makes that response.
I'm sorry, Justice Kennedy?
That is substantially different when you get that type of response from the juror. I think the trial judges certainly do have broad discretion. And during my time on the bench, if I recall correctly, there was never a panel busted. And I don't know if that was because we had larger panels in cases like yours. So is that the answer, to have larger panels and face a problem that Justice Brister stated? Or is the answer, as Justice Priscilla may have talked about, is just to eliminate voir dire and hand that to the judges, as they do in the federal court, because we give the judges the discretion to be the gatekeepers of the evidence, which is as crucial as in panel and the jury?
I think to eliminate voir dire would be an outrageous act by this court.
Why?
Frankly. And I will say that with all recognizing how that might offend some members of the court. But I think that would be such a break. I think voir dire is not only recognized by the courts in this state historically, but also the United States Supreme Court as an integral part of jury selection. And you have to be able to identify people who say, I will not listen to all the evidence.
Why can't a judge do that?
Well, let me say this. Now, and that's the second thing I want to get to. The court asked the question to the second panel, the question that I have read. That was done without objection. The court does have broad discretion. The court, in that instance, took over the questioning as to that sensitive question, asked that question herself without objection from plaintiff's counsel. And she structured it. We may have talked about how it was going to be asked, but she wrote out the question herself, and she asked it, and it was done without objection from plaintiff's counsel. What happened was we did not have a big enough panel. Now, there are some cases that, by their very nature, medical malpractice cases are often the case where you will bust a panel, where you will disqualify so many jurors because it's doctors. And we are all familiar with tort reform, and we're all familiar with the publicity about medical malpractice insurance and things like that. So in those cases, it is customary to have a larger panel. What happened in this case was we were told on Friday afternoon we could not get a pool. There was no pool on Friday, and it's in the record, that we would have a third panel, but we would have 72 instead of the 48 of the first panel or the 50 of the second panel. We would have 72. Judge Spiegelman was concerned about the herd mentality, and I think that is completely within her discretion. So she said, you know, what we're going to do is, instead of asking this question, the seatbelt question, to the entire panel, and people start seeing, oh, you know, hands are going up, and people say, well, you know, maybe I've got the problem too, so I'll get out of this jury service. She said, we will not ask the seatbelt question during the general questioning, and we will bring the jury in. And it's in our brief. We've cited, I'll read it if the court is interested, but I don't think I need to. And she said, we will bring them in, we will do a general voir dire, I will give a general description of the case, and then we will bring them in one at a time, and I will ask. And what she said specifically was, she said, I will go through kind of very similar to the spiel I went through with our second panel and asked them the sympathy question. The sympathy question was Hyundai's question. It's a 4.5-year-old little girl. Can you put aside that sympathy and listen to all the evidence and be fair and impartial to Hyundai? And then I will ask the seatbelt question, and then I will ask the front seat question. And then I'm going to allow each of you to ask any additional questions you want of that juror. Now, what happened was we did the general voir dire. We did not ask the seatbelt question. When we brought the first juror in, she changed her mind. And we said at that time, and I told the court, I said, intentionally or not, Your Honor, the court, and she said, we are not going to go any further into seat belts. And I told the court then on the record we would have been ambushed.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, court.
Mr. Keltner, as among the three parties in front of the bar at trial, the plaintiff, defendant, the judge, how many of those three actually want a fair and impartial jury?
One.
The judge.
Yes. No doubt about that. And that's why Texas cases have traditionally, like those of every other state, given immense discretion to the trial judge. It is because, and I think this is terribly important here, the judge gets to see what is happening and what the impression on panels are of certain things and begin to understand how the jury is reacting to the line of questions.
Can you explain to me the difference between the question that we're talking about here, even though we don't know quite what it is, and the question that Hyundai posed during voir dire, which was, here's what happened to the 4-year-old girl in this case, and can everybody still be fair?
No matter who the victim is, it doesn't make any difference to the operative facts of a case. Just like whether the victim be black or white, an atheist or Baptist, it makes no difference to how the jury should answer those questions.
Well, it shouldn't, but it does.
It can, but those
that's,
are
that's
things...
Why we, that's why we don't... You can't remand on damages, but not reverse on liability. Because we all know...
But I think that's the real reason. The other thing is you need to remember is when we got to the third panel, that question was put off limits for us as well. And the judge was trying, and let me tell you, there were lots of hits on that one too. In the second voir dire, there were 10 hits on that one, 10 or 13, three of which were the same hits that the same jurors said that the seatbelt issue would make a difference. But here's what I think the crucial
thing. So they were biased against both of you?
Yes.
Who were they going to rule for?
Well, you know, those are always interesting issues. We agree with Mr. Cadell on one issue. Voir dire is important. But should voir dire decide cases? Is it correct to say, should we glorify the idea that the case is won when picking a jury? The answer to that's got to be no, or justice is merely advocacy, and that's all.
What's your view of rehabilitation?
I think, Your Honor, and that's not an issue in this case, but I believe you ought to be able, like I know the court is considering Cortez, I think that the court ought to be able to follow up with questions even on cause issues. Here's why. The cause issues that are, again, in the government code, section 65102, are divided into various things, and they deal to a great extent to the charge that eventually, or the instructions the jury's going to get, but only after the jury's sworn in. 226A, the majority of the instructions don't happen to the voir dire panel. They happen to the jury after they're sworn. And the court needs to be able to say, hey, look, I'm going to instruct you that you're going to have to listen to all the evidence. And it's okay to have an initial reaction to a certain matters. But I want you just to say that you're going to agree with me, you're going to keep your mind open. Those are the kinds of things you ought to do. I think you ought to be able to do that. The evil here, and it is an evil, is that any time jurors are purged from a panel because of their reaction to evidence, you don't get a fair and impartial jury. You get a jury that tends to look at the case from one side's viewpoint. It isn't any longer a cross-section of the community. Mr. Cadell argued to you that it ought to be appropriate to mention a fact and say, listen, with this fact, is it dispositive to you? And he used that term, and the term was used at trial as well. Or can you keep an open mind What does that do? It does two things. It's great advocacy, by the way. It is very good advocacy, but it does two things. It removes people that don't think it's dispositive or think that the issue may be dispositive, and it encourages others to believe that that fact ought not be dispositive. That's not fair. It doesn't make a fair jury.
I know the time's up here. Let me just ask you a question. I want to ask you the same thing. Same question that I asked Mr. Dell, and you touched this briefly, but what are your thoughts, having tried a lot of cases, both you gentlemen have, and as a trial judge, I, quite frankly, I enjoyed voir dire, but what are your thoughts about handing that monumental task to the judge as they do in federal courts?
Your Honor, I agree with Mr. Cadell on this one. I don't think the court ought to do that, and in Texas, there are two important reasons why not. We still have a judiciary that is horribly underfunded. We have a judiciary in which we have less than one penny of every tax dollar going to the third branch of government. Judges, trial judges in Texas don't have the time to learn the issues in the case to be able to do that. Federal courts have a lot more talent and a lot more people doing that.
Judges are more talented than
No. A lot more talented briefing attorneys and staff attorneys and the like. I would urge not. The other thing is, sometimes in Texas in the past, we've gotten the idea that lawyers ought not to be involved in helping get the cases tried. I think that's a mistake. I agree with the Texas Voter Brief on that issue. I don't think this case, the judiciary in this state has the resources to be able to do that.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. The court will take a brief recess.
All rise.